Welcome to Basic Brewing Radio for Thursday, January 30th, 2014. I'm James Spencer. Here at Basic Brewing Radio, we're all about home brewing. This week, homebrewer Dan Pixley joins us to talk about an ongoing sour experiment that's 2 years in the making so far. And Dr. Martin O'Neill fills us in on the new brewing program at Auburn University. If you're new to home brewing and would like to get into the hobby for the first time, check out our website, basicbrewing.com, where you can find archives of our audio and video podcasts and our DVDs to walk you through basic and more advanced brewing techniques. You can follow me on Twitter. My username is Basic Brewing, all one word. Also, you can find me on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing.james. And we have a show page on Facebook at facebook.com/basicbrewing. We're on Google Plus, too. And thanks again to everybody clicking on the Amazon.com associate link on our basicbrewing.com site. You know how that works. Whenever you think of Amazon shopping, go to our website first, basicbrewing.com. Click on our Amazon link, and that will take you to Amazon.com where you'll shop like always, and you'll be helping to support this show. The good news is that it won't cost you any extra. We have associate links for Brew Your Own magazine and the American Homebrewers Association on our site, too, that work in the similar fashion. You can find our Basic Brewing iPhone app on iTunes and our Android app on Amazon.com. We're on the BlackBerry podcast directory. We're on the Stitcher app. We're on Windows Phone directory, too. All that good stuff. Check out our Brewer's Logbook at basicbrewingshop.com. In the front is a blank calendar that you can use to track your fermentations and plan your brews. There is room in the back to log the details of up to 50 batches of beer. If you want to put a tip in our tip jar, some coinage in our guitar case, you can go to basicbrewing.com/support. Thanks to everybody who's done so already. Protect your precious beer with one of our growler bags. Check those out at basicbrewingshop.com. This Friday, I plan to post a new Basic Brewing video episode that Steve Wilkes and I did. In the episode, Steve and I sample my pineapple saison, which turned out pretty good. And Steve cooks up a very quick and easy seafood stir fry that is delicious and nutritious. So keep an eye out for that. I got a fun present from Jamie Burnham at the Beer Nut in Salt Lake City. It's a calendar featuring members of the Hop Bombshells, an all-female homebrew club. They say, "Our mission is to empower women to brew while increasing knowledge and skill of making beer with a bunch of kick-ass women of the Salt Lake City Valley." It's a cool calendar. It's very well done. Very tastefully done, by the way. And a portion of the sales of it will be donated to local charities. Check that out on hopbombshells.com. That's hopbombshells.com. My calendar is gracing the wall of the sound booth right here. And thanks to Jamie again for that. Matt from Virginia writes, after last week's beer cheese show, Matt says, "Regarding cheese and beer, the Chimay monks make a cheese they wash in their beer. I saw it at our local Wegmans and thought to myself, I like cheese. I love beer. A twofer. Two-for-one deal. But just as your guest described, only a little bit of the yeast character comes through. It's mostly just, well, funky." Matt says, "I'm not a huge fan of the funky stuff, so I couldn't help but think, what a waste of perfectly good Chimay." That sounds tasty to me, actually. The funk is not for everybody. Funky monks. Brad from Appleton, Maine writes, "Your latest podcast on beer and cheese hit close to home. My wife and I run a small state-licensed cheese production facility here in Maine. Check out appletoncreamery.com. AppletonCreamery.com. I'm also an avid homebrewer, cider, wine, and mead maker, so the two enterprises are very complementary." Well, we've heard from Brad in Appleton, Maine a bunch over the years. "We've been producing a beer-washed rind cheese for years, and I have a mead-making friend who is also married to a cheesemaker who does the same with his meads. Yum! At cheese conventions here in the States and in Canada, I've also enjoyed products that were made with curd soaked in brown ales and other darker beers. And when pressed into wheels and blocks, the result is an impressive look, not unlike a slab of Italian marble." Very cool. I asked Brad for some of their beer washed cheese, but he said it's seasonal and not around right now. So it looks like the idea of beer made or cheese made with beer has been out there for a while. Moving along quickly now because we get a lot of ground to cover. Last week I mentioned registration is open until February 14th for the new brewing program at Auburn University. And I said it had an online component, but it is actually all based on distance learning. So that means that anybody who listens to this podcast is eligible to apply. This week I have Dr. Martin O'Neill on the line to give us more details. Dr. Martin O'Neill, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Absolute pleasure to chat to you.
Now, you've got a very distinct Alabama accent.
I do. I like to say I come from northeast Alabama, which is approximately 5,000 miles away in Northern Ireland. So, of course, James, I joke with people here all the time. You know, the Scots-Irish, while the very public face of Irish America is up in the northeast, the Scots-Irish had a huge migration to the southeast here some 300, 350 years ago. So I'm just back to make sure that they're following through with all of that good old Southern hospitality that we lent them all that time ago.
The past couple of years have been good for Alabama as far as brewing is concerned. Last year. The homebrewing was legalized in the state, and now Auburn gets a brewing program. So how did that come about?
It does, and I guess one is very much connected with the other. To take it a step back, though, I mean, my background had always been in food and beverage, and you know, when I took on the program here with colleagues at Auburn 11 years ago, I was sort of very instrumental with others in introducing a very strong beverage element to it. You know, initially in enology and wine and sort of wine evaluation, as it were, and then we've branched off over the years into beer because I've always been a home brewer. I've always had a love of beer, and I guess, for want of a better term, I'm best described as being a beer tourist. But the very serious thing was really economic and educational need. As you rightly indicated, craft brewing has taken off all over the country, and Alabama has, you know, gotten a hold of that in huge form over the last 4 or 5 years. And what we've noticed is that while there has been an explosion of interest in craft brewing and in product coming from outside of the state for sale in, there wasn't a corresponding, increased in educational programming. So you've got a lot of people who are in the industry who are crying out for it. And in addition to that, there's the economics that attach themselves. I mean, if you want to get an education in anything brewing related up to this point within the state, you had to leave the state to get it. So we responded in an economic sense, we responded in an educational sense, and we've been very fortunate to enjoy, you know, just considerable support from the Alabama Brewers Guild and from many of the craft brewers that have been, you know, successful here within the state over recent years. And they certainly helped smooth the launch pad, as it were, for getting the program approved within the university.
So tell us about the program itself.
Well, the program is, I guess you would call it a professional program in a sense. It's a post-baccalaureate, but it's not quite a master's degree. It's what we call a graduate certificate program. And it is designed across 6 courses, which are science-based, engineering-based, materials-based, and then there's a work practice element to it also, which we call advanced practicum, which are really designed for people who are in brewing, whether home or commercial, who don't have an educational background but would like it, to get that and to use that as they see fit. There are people who have indicated that they've been lifelong home brewers who would like to get into commercial brewing, either to work for someone else or to move into business in an entrepreneurial sense in their own right. There are people who are working in brewing right now who really need the knowledge and the education. There are people who have a certain amount but would like more to move up and move on. And of course, the wonderful thing that attaches itself at the end of the program is we become a testing center for the Institute for Brewing and Distilling out of London. And upon successful completion of the grad cert, you're then eligible to start sitting for their certification examinations, which of course are somewhat of a gold standard when it comes to the brewing industry at large. Our goal longer term is actually to establish a master brewing program in its own right. You know, that's 6 courses in university terminology, that's 18 credits toward 33 credits, which would be a master's program. And our goal is to, I hate to use the term, but to get into bed, as it were, and partner up with one of the well-known international schools with a view to sort of co-tagging a master's degree, a dual certified program upon completion. And we're hoping that what that would require is, you know, the program as it stands right now is entirely distance education, but we would, for the master's degree, require students to come on campus for a semester and then study abroad at the partner institution for a semester before walking. So that's who we are. It's a little distinctive in a number of regards. It's distinctive in the sense that it's at the graduate level, and it's distinctive because it's multidisciplinary in a sense. We've got, strangely enough, we've got microbiologists and biochemists in the vet school here who are teaching on the program. We've got soils specialists from the agriculture college teaching on the program. We've got entrepreneurship specialists over in the business school teaching in the program, and we've got folks here also within my own college and my own department teaching on the program. It's also unique, I guess, from the perspective that we have a business element in it. I've done a lot of research over recent years with the homebrewing community and the Homebrewers Association, and then more recently with the Brewers Association dealing with craft brewers and, you know, what motivates them, what gets them into business, the challenges they face. And one of the things that we realized is that while a lot of the programs that are out there, and there aren't a lot really, do a really good job with the science and the engineering, there's not a strong focus on the business element of this. And, you know, if you know anything about craft, it's small, medium-sized, owner-operated establishments or partnered enterprises. And, you know, navigating that minefield from idea to securing the capital to dealing with the legal environment to opening the doors is a difficult process. So we're tackling that. And then at the other end of that, as you know, there are a lot of people, they produce a wonderful product, but, you know, moving that product through the marketplace is a whole other story. So we're dealing with that also. So we've been, I want to say, in development mode for about 3 or 4 years, and we've taken it very, very slowly, and we've done that deliberately. And actually, to this point, we haven't even marketed the program. There's just been so much interest on the back of the news media announcement following the trustees' approval of the program. So we've been very fortunate with it, and it's something we're all very excited about here. And our first cohort will start with us in the fall semester of 14. So we're just chomping at the bit to get going.
Talk a bit about the involvement with Oscar Blues.
Yes, Oscar, you all know Oscar Blues, and you know of their pedigree. And, of course, Dale Katechis, who is a wonderful individual, is a legacy alumni here at the university. What we're doing is we're dealing with, and we've always been of the frame of mind, that we're dealing with this in a distance education sense. Now, in order to do that, you need to move beyond the frame of thinking as it relates to traditional distance education. So it's not a chalk and talk or death by PowerPoint. What we're trying to do is we're trying to bring the real world into the classroom. And we've collaborated with Dale and other members here of the state brewing community to go out with a very high-end video capture company out of Atlanta here in Georgia, known as RealView, to sort of capture real-world footage. Now, to put that in context, you know, while delivering, you've got a faculty member who's going through, let's say, the theory, going through the concepts and principles surrounding a particular process. Then they're jumping into the sort of B-roll type material in the lab, but then they're cutting out to the real world and showing what that means in an actual commercial sense. So we're using Dale and Oscar Blues, their property over in Brevard, and as we grow, we hope also to get back and work with them in Longmont and others within the state here to show best practice from a commercial sense. We always knew we needed a public face, and we knew we were going to get that support in state, but that the connection with Oscar Blues just always seemed like a perfect fit, and he jumped right on it from the get-go. I mean, he was 100% supportive from the very first meeting. So it's been a tremendous partnership to this point.
There are 10 openings, is that correct?
Well, you know, that's interesting. That's what I would like, but I work with people who are very dollars and cents focused, and they would like more than 10. And I'm sort of one of these people who believes in crawling before walking before running, which is probably why it's taken us 4 years to get to this point. I just believe in crossing T's and dotting I's. And, you know, I announced that we were probably going to take 10 in the first cohort, and the local news media got a hold of that, and we were just swamped with expressions of interest. And so much so that we decided that if need be, we could go to 30 in the first cohort. So the announcement went out last week. The website opened up last week with all of the application procedures. Everybody that had written in, everybody that had emailed, everybody that had called had been dropped into a listserv, and they all but one, and I was able to follow up with him 2 days later. I'm not sure what happened. They all got the email announcing that the application process was open. So we're going to sit and review it. I mean, it's one thing to have, you know, multiple hundreds of expressions of interest, and then to get people to convert, you know, is a whole other thing. The big advantage, I think, that we have is that, again, it's distance education. People can go to work and do what they do on a daily basis and still deal with us at night or on the weekends. So I would prefer 10, but we do have the capacity to go to 30 in that first year.
Since there is such a limited involvement, at least at first, are Alabama residents going to have a bit of an advantage over out-of-state and out-of-country?
No, absolutely not. We're bringing a very objective evaluation system to making the decisions. And, you know, we've clarified with absolutely everyone that, you know, not making it this year does not mean you're not going to make it next year. It just means that people have done a better job of representing themselves. And that's why, really, one of the things that we're really looking at is that, how will you put it, that application letter. In other words, your journey to this point, you know, what's in this for you and where are you taking it longer term? So, you know, we're as a faculty going to sit down and we're going to screen all of those, and address or point of origin or the postage stamp makes no difference to the outcome. Absolutely not.
Well, is there an easy URL where people can find more information?
It's brewing.auburn.edu, and it'll take you straight into it. Yeah.
Well, excellent. Well, congratulations on the new program, and all the best of luck.
Yeah, no, thank you very much. It's lovely to talk to you, and, you know, I hope the story finds a good home and that people are receptive to what we're doing. And, you know, if we can be of any assistance to anyone, they will see how to get a hold of me from the website, and I look forward to chatting.
I believe the cost of the program is $18,000, and the application process is pretty involved, so it's not something to go into lightly, but this may be a great opportunity for future brewers out there who need some formal education. Let me know if you get into the program. I'd like to hear how it works. And good luck to everybody with that. Now let's get to the meat of the show. Let's talk to Dan Pixley about a sour experiment that he's been working on for 2 years. It started out as a modest small batch experiment, but Dan has expanded it into something with a larger scope. Dan Pixley, welcome to Basic Brewing Radio.
Thank you. It's an honor to be here.
Well, you've been working on a project, a sour project, for 2 years. And I know that beginning homebrewers, you know, they're wanting to get their beers ready to drink in 2 weeks. So what's it been like to be working on this thing for so long?
Well, you know, it's something that I've kind of forgotten about, to be honest. The bulk of the project was aging the beer almost 2 years in a closet, and I basically just forgot about the beers. The airlocks even went dry a few times on me, which is not good. But you know, it wasn't something that I expected anything to come out of. To be honest, it wasn't something that I was really worried about.
So you didn't go into it with high expectations.
Yep. Yeah, that's correct.
And it's a small batch experiment, mm-hmm. Or project, so low stakes in that regard as well.
Yep. And it was also 100% extract, so I didn't put a bunch of time into it. You know, when you do an all-grain batch and something goes wrong with it, it's heartbreaking because you put so much time into it. This I put, you know, maybe an hour of time into this thing.
Yeah, let's go back to the very beginning. What was the seed of this whole thing?
Okay, yeah, it was basically, there's a thread on Homebrew Talk in the Sour Lambic section by a gentleman named Jeffrey Crane. He has the blog Bikes, Beer, and Adventures. He goes by Almighty on Homebrew Talk, and he posted a thread called Easy Way to Make Sour Beers with dregs and 1 gallon batch of wort. And it was funny because actually the first couple of posts responses, people were kind of criticizing him, but really it's a great technique. Some of the other guys, basically what they do in this thread, they brew an extra gallon of beer if it's a low IBU, you know, recipe, or they'll fiddle with it so that they can pull some off before they add in all their hops, and pull a gallon off and set it aside and drink a commercial sour beer like a Russian River or something that's not pasteurized. Cascade, Cantillon, Three Fontaine, and any of those that aren't pasteurized, and just drink the beer. Leave about a quarter to a half an inch of beer in there. Be very careful not to disturb the sediment, and then they'll swirl it up and throw it in that 1 gallon, jug, and let it go.
And what you did was first of all, what were the criticisms that he was getting on the thread?
Let's see here. Looking at it, he made some points about how you're not messing up the rest of your equipment. You don't need a lot of space. You don't need to buy more equipment just to store the beer. He says it can take a long time, and you might not end up with good beer. So he's talking about it only being a 1 gallon batch. And there's some responses in there like, you still bought jugs. Yeah, people were just a little bit cynical, I guess. But he kind of had to, if you read the thread, he almost had to like argue his way into getting some attention on it. But I think the bulk of the thread is probably is mostly people saying, wow, this is cool and this is how I'm doing it.
So it sounds like to me that the criticism was what I hear a lot whenever I talk about doing small batches, less than 1 gallon. It's like, why would I want to take all day to do 1 gallon? Well, you're not taking all day. You're, especially if you're doing an extract batch, you're basically taking the same amount of time as you would making a starter. Mm-hmm. But you're making something, that could be very interesting and experimental. And if it turns out well, you can scale it up to a larger batch. If it doesn't, there's not much lost. So
yeah, and that's the thing, and we can talk about this part later, is that this 1 gallon batch, if you've aged it for 2 years and it turns out ridiculously good, like I got lucky and it did, you're going to be able to reuse that 1 gallon and turn it into something even better.
Right. Well, let's go back to the beginning, and you did something that I hadn't thought of. I've put dregs, the dregs from bottles into a starter, but you kind of did the other way around.
Kind of the technique that he talks about on his thread. You're talking about how I added the wort to the bottles, I think?
Yes, yes.
Oh, that's right, yeah. So, yeah, my thinking was, why use another container? I just used the bottles themselves. So when I drank the beer, I put some plastic wrap over the top of the rubber band and stuck them in the fridge until I was ready to use them. That was in a long period of time that those sat. So when I was ready to use them, I took them out, got them up to room temperature, made my starter wort, and I just poured a little bit of sour wort into each one of the bottles, covered it back up, left it at room temperature for a week. Yeah, and that's how I did my starter.
Yeah, that's brilliant. I mean, that way you don't have to sanitize, another piece of gear. You just pour the wort, the extract wort, into the bottles, and let the yeast get started up that way.
Yeah, there was an article in, I think, this last Zymergy on the Australian sparkling ale technique, and they were talking about harvesting dregs from bottles. And there was a note in there about using one of those flame things that your buddy Steve uses to make the you know, the caramelized.
Oh yeah, the propane burner.
Yeah, and I can't remember the exact details. So folks might want to go back there and reference that. I think they'll burn the top of the bottles just to make sure that there's nothing on the top there. I believe that's the technique that they're using. I didn't do that, so I'm just mentioning that.
Yeah, I think remembering way back when I first started homebrewing, reading Charlie Papazian's New Joy of Homebrewing, and I think he uses just a lighter to flame the top of the bottle, mm-hmm. just so they're, you know, just so anything that's on the outside gets taken care of.
Yeah, yeah.
So what was the next step? You a few days in the bottle with the starter wort, and what happens next?
Yeah. After that, it was time to make the wort. The recipe comes from both the Jeff Sparrow's Sour Brewing Book and the Jamil Zainashef and John Palmer Brewing Classic Styles. Now, in the Jeff Sparrow book, he talks about extract lambics as being something that you should avoid. And I left that book at my work, so I think that book is a little bit older. Correct me if I'm wrong. I don't know if you know.
Yeah, I think it is.
Yeah, so I think, you know, extracts have improved over the years here, you know, recently. And in the Zainashef book, Zainashef Palmer book, they actually encourage you to use extract. And it's based off of a homebrewer who's won a bunch of NHC medals with his extract lambics. So, you know, I'm like, might as well just keep this low risk and just go with extract, see what happens.
So what kind of extract and what gravity are you shooting for?
The gravity was around 1080. It was a little bit high. Hmm. The cask, the dregs that I used, which were Russian River Temptation, I had two bottles of that. I had a bottle of Cascade Brewing Seigneur Royale and Cascade Brewing Creek. All the bugs that those guys are using are pretty alcohol tolerant bugs. So I figured 1080, I should be fine. And which I was. The recipe is really simple. It's about 50% Pilsner dry malt extract, 50% wheat dry malt extract, and then about, for my 3-gallon batch, it was, 4 ounces of maltodextrin. And that's for the Brettanomyces. The Brewing Classic Styles book leaves out the maltodextrin, but I think that the maltodextrin is something that you would want to include, because over time the Brettanomyces will break that down and you'll get some more, you know, interesting flavors from that.
So you basically made a 3-gallon wort and split it into thirds, right?
Yeah, that's correct. Another technique I used for the hops, I didn't have any lambic aged hops or anything. You can buy lambic aged hops, by the way, now. That's probably what I would do now. But back then I wasn't, you know, I didn't totally know what I was doing back then. So, but in the Jeff Sparrow's book, there's a technique of baking your hops in the oven. And so that's what I did for that. But I split the 3 gallons into three different 1-gallon jugs. And I pitched one bottle of the Russian River Temptation into one bottle of the Creek from Cascade Brewing into one, and then I blended one of the other Temptation bottle and the Cascade Brewing Seigneur Royale together into the third one.
And so when you say you pitched one bottle, you're talking about the starters in those bottles that you made from the dregs.
That's correct. Yeah,
you're not using a whole bottle of it.
Oh no. No, you're drinking that.
Yeah. So you had some, and I should say that you did a series of videos on YouTube that you put in a playlist where people can watch this process as it went over the years. How would people find that?
If you just go onto YouTube and you search Dan, D-A-N, space A-B-A, I should be the first channel that comes up. The channel URL is Eric and Bastardale, and that's a long story. So.
Well, I can guess. Yeah. There may be a certain beer that you like.
Long back in the day, it's the beer that kind of got me in the craft beer many years ago.
So watching this video, or watching these videos, you had some different results from each of these small batches.
Yeah. Yeah. I tasted them about 6 months later. One of them developed a pellicle. The one that developed the pellicle was the blend between the Temptation and the Cascade. And the other two didn't develop a pellicle. The Temptation one fermented out on its own. The Cascade one didn't ferment visually. I didn't take any gravity readings, but I never got a visual fermentation. So after about 3 weeks, I think I let it sit. I finally added some USO4 into that one, and then it blew up. I should have put a blow off. It needed a blow off. It was all over the place. So, and then 6 months later, the results were pretty interesting, I think. And then the continuing results are even more interesting, I think. The one with the pellicle on it tasted the best. It had the best fruit flavors. It was really, really intense, very sour. In fact, all of them were very intense and very sour, more sour than any commercial sour beer that I've ever had. The creek was by itself, Cascade Brewing Creek. It had oxidated, and I think that it oxidated. It could have happened before I pitched the yeast because I waited so long, or it happened when the airlocks went dry. It wasn't that color when I pitched the yeast, so I think it was when the airlocks went dry.
Yeah, it's one of the benefits of the videos that you can see that batch is significantly darker than the others.
Yeah, it looked purple. Well, the others were orange, you know. And it tasted, it was like sour up front and then cardboard in the middle of the palate. And then at the end, it was like super, super tart, like attack your palate tart. And we can talk about that one a little more. Sure. And then the third one was Temptation Only. And it was nail polish. It had a pretty good sourness, but it wasn't as complex as the other two. And it just had this really nasty nail polish thing going on.
So the sourness that you were getting, was it kind of a vinegary kind of sour? How would you describe that?
Yeah, none of them were vinegary. And that's one thing that that Jeffrey Crane told me to look for in the oxidized one is vinegar. But I don't think there's much acetobacter. The Cascade Brewing doesn't have any Brettanomyces in it. All they use is lactobacillus. So it was just sour. There was no vinegar, which makes sense, you know. Mm-hmm. Unless I somehow got acetobacter in that batch, I wouldn't have gotten vinegar. And the Russian River, I don't know if they have acetobacter or not, but I never did get any vinegar flavors.
So you say you want to talk a bit more about the oxidized batch.
Yeah, the oxidized one, I tasted it maybe a year and a half, 6 months, and then another 12 months maybe. And the oxidation is actually going away in the beer. And I thought, oh, that's because Brettanomyces is a deoxidizer. Maybe it's breaking down those compounds. Because if you listen to Chad Jacobson's talk, he has a really nice, 2-hour presentation on YouTube. It's not as technical as his blog is. And he talks about Brettanomyces being able to break down things like cellulose. The Brett can break down almost anything that's organic, I think. So I thought it was that, but then I remembered that there was no Brettanomyces in there, so I don't know what's going on in that beer, but the oxidation is going away slowly.
So what's next? I mean, what was the next step besides just waiting?
Let's see. So the next step was after hearing Basic Brewing Radio's podcast.
On, I've heard of that.
Yeah. With Ethan Tripps on doing the Solera, I decided I was the beer, the one beer that turned out really good, the one with the pellicle on it. It was really good, but it was so intense. You know, I mean, I don't think anybody else besides me or, you know, real sour heads are going to want to drink it. So what I did is I brewed up 4 gallons of wort, the same exact recipe, and I pitched that 1 gallon along with the dregs that had been sitting there for 2 years into a 5 gallon fermenter and pitched that 4 gallons of wort on top of it. And threw in some USO5 and just let it ferment.
So why did you decide to throw in the California ale yeast or the Chico strain rather than just let the bugs that were what is essentially a starter do the
right
trick?
Well, it's been my experience that so far anyway that If you don't get a good fermentation, you're going to risk either infection or oxidation happening. So I was paranoid about it because I at this point I was like I want to keep this going. You know, I want this to work. It became important. You know, whereas the previous 2 years I didn't really care, right? So I just wanted to be safe. That's why I pitched the USO5.
And what happened?
It fermented. You know, did a normal USO5 fermentation. I think about a month and a half. I tasted it, and I also put some oak spiral. I put an oak spiral and some oak cubes in it because I like oak in sour beers. I know that's not traditional, but I like oak flavor. I think the vanilla tannin kind of complements sourness, So I tasted it, and a month and a half later, it was way better than it was by itself in the 1 gallon. Hmm. So I think in some ways the 1 gallon was so sour that it hid the other flavors, the complexity that was really in there. So so doing this lightened the sourness and allowed my palate to pick up all kinds of great fruit flavors in this beer.
Now, did you get a pellicle? Was this the one that had the crazy pellicle on top of it?
No, that was the second go for the Solera. The first one, it didn't. Let me back up. It didn't really develop a pellicle. It started to get a film on top of it, but it wasn't a good, you know, bubbly pellicle yet. Which makes sense because the USO5 outcompetes, you know, the bacteria and the Brett, because the USO5, you know, Saccharomyces, it just takes off, and it hogs up all the sugars, doesn't give the bugs anything to do. So, you know, I think I got a little bit of sourness in there from pitching the USO5 at the same time, but not that much. And the Brett didn't have enough time to make its pellicle, so. But it tasted great. So
how long did you say a month and a half before you tasted it?
Yeah, it was about a month and a half before I tasted it. And I decided to bottle 5 bottles because at that point I wanted to figure out how to carbonate it. So I just used some Cooper Carb Drops, which is what I normally use to carbonate beer when I bottle. Most of the time I keg now, but, so I bottled about 5 bottles. And those bottles are still not carbonated. The USO, because I didn't add any yeast or anything, the USO5, the Saccharomyces, and this might be different for different strains, maybe Belgian strains are better at this, but USO5, it just does its thing, and then it, I guess maybe because of the low pH, it just dies. It just goes dormant and dies, I guess. So at that point, I knew that I was going to have to add some champagne yeast to get this stuff carbonated. I was a little bit worried about bottle bombs, but I talked to some professional brewers here locally who've done some sour home brewing, and they seem to think I was going to be okay. So we'll see what happens.
You'll post a video of the cleanup process.
Yeah. If you're wrong. Yeah, hopefully that doesn't happen. We'll see. So then I let it go another month and a half, and I bottled with champagne yeast and a little bit of sugar in a bottling bucket. And that's what I've got going now.
But it's a Solera project. So in the Solera theme, you take some out and then you put some back in, right?
Yeah. So I bottled 2 gallons of it. This was now 3 months after I put the original 4 gallons in. And then I made 2 gallons more of wort, same recipe. Put it in the fermenter. And this time I didn't add any yeast because I have some theories about that we can talk about.
Sure.
And I'm sure I'm not the most experienced or knowledgeable, you know, home brewer out there. But I try to piece together information from all these guys that, like Mike Tonsmeyer and Chad Jacobson and the guys on the Homebrew Talk and the Lambic and Sour Brewing section, you know, your podcasts. And,
You do have experience, though. I mean, it seems like to me that there's a lot of variability in this process. And, you know, it is still kind of a new fairly new wide field, at least on a widespread basis. So, you know, you could come up with some stuff that nobody else knows.
I suppose so. Yeah, there's guys out there that are kind of using the same, well, at least the 1 gallon process, you know, doing a whole lot more with it. And yeah, I mean, I guess I came up with something kind of original of scaling the 1 gallon up to 5 gallons and then from then on doing a Solera.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so anyway, when I pitched the 2 gallons of wort in there, I didn't pitch any yeast. And it just blew up. The Brettanomyces, it took about 6 days. The Brettanomyces just blew up and made this amazing pellicle.
Hmm.
And I decided not to put any Saccharomyces in it this time. And so what my theory is on that is, going back to when I pitched the USO5 that first time and no pellicle happened, well, you know, it makes sense. If you don't pitch the Saccharomyces, you're going to give the Brett and the Lactobacillus and the bacteria the advantage.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, the old adage is that you can't control sour beers. You know, sour beers are up to nature. Well, I think in some ways you can control it. If you don't pitch your Saccharomyces, I think you're going to get more sourness and more Brett character out of your beer. You know, and it goes back to, you see other methods along these lines, like the Berliner Weiss method, where you add lactobacillus in your wort, keep it at, you know, 90 to 100 degrees Fahrenheit, let that go for a few days, then crash it down to 68, and then pitch your yeast. And that gets you a much more sour beer than if you were just to pitch the lactobacillus at the same time or pitch it after fermentation.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so.
Well, plus, I mean, it seems like to me that you had, when you put the second round, you know, the 2 gallons to top it back up, you had a larger population of the bugs, you know, the non-Saccharomyces bugs in there.
Right.
So, you know, you had a stronger force to take control at that point.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. Yeah, the Brettanomyces and the bacteria really hangs in there. At least these strains did. Cascade Brewing's Lactobacillus is, from what I've read, is pretty well known as being a monster of a Lactobacillus, but the Saccharomyces it just dies out real quick.
Done.
Yeah.
Well, you know, we always, or at least when I was beginning home brewing, and we've done some experiments along these lines, you know, people always talked about getting your beer off of the primary yeast cake as quickly as possible so that you don't get autolysis, you don't get off flavors from those yeast cells dying and expelling their guts into the beer. You know, here you've got yeast in there that you know, is some of it is a couple of years old and is going to get older as you go along. Are you just going to keep the project in that same fermenter, or are you going to rack away at some point, or what are your thoughts about that?
That's an interesting thing. I've been monitoring Mike Tonsmeyer's blog, The Mad Fermentationist, on that issue. And he's kind of gone from one stance to another, I think. Originally, he would say just leave it on there because Belgian breweries will do that for up to like 3 or 4 years. Mm. They'll leave theirs in primary for that long. But he referenced somebody else that was doing a Solera that started to get meaty off flavors from yeast autolysis. And I actually did get that in the Russian River Temptation Only, one with the nail polish. Mm-hmm. The first 6 months I didn't taste it, but after, you know, at the 2 year mark, I was getting some meaty flavors in there, and I don't know for sure if that was from autolysis, but I think it was. I guess I missed one step here. After I pitched the USO5, I stepped up the 1 gallon to the 5 gallons, pitched the USO5, and let it go. Mm-hmm. I actually did rack that off of yeast cake. And then I brewed a sour brown ale and racked that onto the yeast cake. So that yeast cake is now off of the Solera and in another fermenter fermenting the brown ale. My plans are is to just keep it going until I do start to taste that. And at that point, I'll rack the beer off and try to save it and throw out the yeast cake.
Or maybe you could just collect just a sample of that to get kind of a starter going again, so that you don't have this giant mass of, you know, old yeast.
Yeah, that's an idea.
Mm-hmm. And you know, then that, you know, whatever is living in that sample that you take from, you know, the old yeast cake, you know, maybe it could grow new cells to do the job.
Yeah,
that's just me talking out of my posterior region, but
that's a good idea. I mean, there's so many different ways to approach it. I could take the Solera one, rack it into another 5 gallon fermenter, and use that one, that, you know, that yeast cake as well. It's the same bugs. I mean, there's so many different things you can do with you know, this the Solera idea.
Well, you could even, I mean, just talking again out of my nether regions, you could split that batch mm-hmm. into another fermenter and, you know, add some other bugs and top that up, or you know, add some fruit or something. You know, that there's so mm-hmm. many so many avenues that you could take to expand the experiment even further.
And that's what I plan on doing this year. Is I want to get another one of these going. I got some East Coast yeast, Bug County. I want to get going with the Solera. I want to do some wild yeast catching this summer, and I want to start experimenting with the fruit. I mean, I guess it's kind of a goose lambic. I'm not sure what you would call it, but it's so fruity and intense that I'm afraid putting fruit on it is going to kind of mess it up, but I don't know. At some point, I have to experiment with that for sure.
Well, I was going to ask what your next step is, but that's, I mean, you're leaning toward that direction.
Mm-hmm.
I guess the future is wide open as far as where you want to go.
Yeah. And I'm going to document it on my YouTube channel. If you guys want to tune in and see what happens, it'll be there. I'll document it there. I believe that we should, as sour beer brewers, we should be documenting and sharing with everybody what we're doing. Mm-hmm. You know, you're doing it with the podcast, and Tonsmeyer and Jacobson are doing it with their blogs and whatnot. So, you know, I want to do it in my way, do it on YouTube.
Well, and that's another point. I mean, this demonstrates the power of, you know, all these, you know, kind of collaborative social media between, you know, Homebrew Talk and then YouTube and podcasts and blogs. the information that's available for homebrewers nowadays is just immense.
Yeah, yeah. YouTube alone has such a great homebrewing community on it. If you don't have a club in your area, you can get on YouTube and start meeting people from all over the world. And we've even done experiments and shared beers and stuff. Yeah, social media is amazing.
And then do you want to talk about, is it Homebrew Wednesday?
That's your Homebrew Wednesday, yeah. There's a homebrewer on YouTube named SJ Poor. That's his username. And a couple years ago, he declared Wednesday is Homebrew Wednesday just for fun. And people like Craig Tube and, you know, a lot of the homebrewers on YouTube picked it up. And basically, it's a way for people to post a video and just say what they've been doing. You know, maybe they'll give some tips. They'll talk about their recipes. They'll, you know, some people will make brewing videos. Yeah, it's pretty awesome. I'd say you probably get at least 20, 30 videos every week, and there's probably 100 to 200 people participating.
Wow. And I'm sure that as we go along with everybody experimenting, everybody sharing things, that rules will be rewritten all over the place.
Yeah. Yeah, but it's fun. The sour beer brewing has really revitalized my home brewing experience. I was, to be honest, almost kind of getting a little bit bored of it. But with sour beer brewing, I mean, it's almost like you're getting back to nature, and it's, you know, we've as a species, we've evolved with sour beer, you know, for thousands and thousands of years, and only in the last 100-150 years we've taken that out of our you know, alcohol experience. So I think people like you and me and, you know, other sour heads get into it for a reason. You get a craving for it, I think, for a reason. Mm-hmm. You know, I think it's just you know, it's a deeper level of brewing.
That's a good point. I mean, you know, back before they figured out what was doing the work in fermenting beer, you know, the variety of yeast strains, Saccharomyces, Brettanomyces, and all the other bugs that were fermenting the beer. Of course, there was variability. You know, of course, there were some beers that turned out better than others. Mm-hmm. And that's where microbiology came in to isolate, you know, a single strain of yeast into, you know, sanitization procedures, locked it down to where you get repeatability and higher quality more consistently.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it did probably take some of the fun out of it.
Yeah, yeah, and there may even be, you know, some health, you know, benefits to it. There's a book called The Art of Fermentation. I can't remember the name of the author off the top of my head, but he talks about how these days we're so germophobic that we're not getting enough bacteria in our diets. And his theory is that sour beer is good for you.
Yeah, and sour fermented. Was he the guy that was on Science Friday the other day? Did you hear that?
No, I didn't.
I can't remember his name either. It might be the same. Might be the same guy. But he was talking about naturally fermented foods like pickles and sauerkraut and I guess, you know, he has fermented lots of stuff that you wouldn't think of fermenting. But
yeah.
You know, it's a way of, number one, it's a way of preservation.
Yeah, Sandor Katz, that's his name, The Art of Fermentation.
Yeah, yeah, that's the guy. He was on Science Friday the other day. So, interesting. Small sour world.
Yeah.
Well, yeah. Cool. Very good. Is there anything else that you can think of that if someone wants to kind of follow your path or riff on your path, so to speak, what other things should we be thinking about?
I guess one thing that I get a lot on my YouTube channel from, you know, from friends I've made there is that they always say, you know, you're crazy, Dan. I can't believe you're doing this. And, you know, I just want to say that it's not that hard. It's not as mystical as a lot of people will try to make it out to be. You know, you might get a lot of misses, but your hits can be really, really good.
Mm-hmm.
And if you use extract, that's fine. You use bottle dregs, you know, they can be hits and misses. I would say try blending bottles more than just using one bottle. You know, try to blend to get a little more diversity of your bugs in there. That seems to give more success rate, I think, for me anyway. Also, check for a pellicle. If your beer doesn't get a pellicle, it's going to be exposed to that oxygen. I know there's a CO2 layer on top there, but I think over time, eventually, the gases are going to mix.
Right.
You know, so a pellicle is always a good thing to look for. So, I mean, you can have minimal amount of effort go into this and possibly get something really, really good. And I say, why not? Just try it.
Well, cool. Well, keep us posted, Dan. We'll be watching your YouTube channel.
I will. Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Dan. Thanks again to Dan. Check out his videos on YouTube. It's interesting to see how those beers evolve over time. And I'm looking forward to hearing about the next phase. Very cool. If you have brewing questions, show suggestions, or just want to say howdy, write to james@basicbrewing.com or just fill out the contact form on basicbrewing.com, and please don't forget to tell us where you're from. Our growler bags are available in our shop. Protect your precious homebrew and craft beer as you take it from place to place. Check out our support link where you can throw a couple of bucks into the tip jar by subscribing financially to our podcasts. Be sure to check out our DVDs, Extract Brewing and Partial Mashing, Stepping into All Grain, Low-Tech Lagering and Decoction Mashing, and Introduction to Wine Kits. You can find them all on our site. We've got combo deals to save you a few bucks if you want to buy more than one DVD at a time. And you can check out our Basic Brewing shirts in the store, too. Our brewer's logbooks are in the store as well. Keep track of up to 50 batches of beer. You can see a listing of the fine folks across the country who sell our DVDs on basicbrewing.com. And if there isn't a vendor in your area, you can order them online in our online shop at basicbrewingshop.com. Thanks very much to everybody who's continued to click on our Amazon.com link. We appreciate the support there. Our featured products that were this week that were purchased through the link are mini purple gift boxes, 2 dozen. And Planet Bike Men's ARS Anatomic Relief Bicycle Saddle. Thanks again. I don't know. Something about the phrase anatomic relief makes me chuckle. Thanks again, everybody. Remember, I can't tell who bought what, so no worries there. Just click on the Amazon.com logo on our site. The next time you feel like Amazon shopping, we greatly appreciate your support. Don't forget, you can also join the American Homebrewers Association or subscribe to Brew Your Own Magazine through our associate links at basicbrewing.com. That's all until next time. Until then, thanks for listening, everybody. I'm James Spencer. Production help for Basic Brewing Radio and our website is provided by Kelly Dodson. Basic Brewing Radio is a production of Active Voicing. We'll talk to you next time, everybody. So long.